On this week's 51%, we speak with a woman leading a veterans group to the Women's March on Washington.
This is such a great and exciting moment for the Women's March for us to say, no, we will not be ignored. We are here, we are contributors, and we are leaders.
Learn about transgender people's concerns in a new administration and hear from a woman in the civil rights movement alongside Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Organizers say that what began as a grassroots effort the day after the November 8th election has grown into something much larger. The January 21st Women's March on Washington is scheduled the day after Donald Trump is sworn in as the nation's 45th president. A coalition of veterans, women and men, is one of the groups joining the march and mobilizing to send a message on Trump's first full day in office. I spoke with one of the organizers, Air Force veteran Pam Campos Palma from New York City, about the importance of gathering her veterans contingent for the march.
It's especially critical. So the Women's March in general is a show of strength, of solidarity. It's a bold message that women's rights are human's rights. And more than anything, it's saying women are not invisible. And who knows that better than women veterans? So for our group, it's Vets Versus Hate, and we're an organic movement of veterans who don't stand for bigotry or hate. And so it's extremely aligned for us to support, for us to be present and to be visible as women veterans and as male veterans who also don't stand or tolerate oppression against women.
What is your concern as both a woman and veteran under the new administration?
There's a lot to be concerned about. So one thing that's really at the forefront is our needs as veterans. We as veterans rely so heavily on the government. So in terms of healthcare, in terms of the services that we receive, education, a lot of that is being put in jeopardy. We're seeing with a lot of vagueness and not really understanding what this next administration is going to do. And so as a woman of color, a veteran, there's a lot at stake. And I think that's why we're seeing so many veterans and so many communities rally together in coalition. You know, a Military Times poll recently came out that I really identified, saying that 55% of women in active duty are personally afraid of the next commander-in-chief and that it'll impact the mission. So for me, it's not really about comparing the past with the new. It's that, you know, we have evidence now, and we are seeing a very different administration that goes beyond specific policies, but an entire kind of shift, right, that really negatively impacts our communities.
So what do you hope is accomplished from the Women's March?
The biggest opportunity is definitely a coalition, being able to come together with so many folks as veterans, coming together as diverse veterans with other military families we're talking to, Gold Star families, and also just mingling with people from other communities that relate to us, and to get to know each other better and be able to support each other better for the long haul. Because let's face it, this is a long haul fight, right? We are all going to be together in many more movements beyond January 21st. And beyond that, the visibility of women's veterans is critical. And it's something we're really excited about. We have already been talking about how, you know, many of us are regarded as wives, or we're there with our brothers, when really we are the veterans ourselves. We are the combat vets. You know, I myself just recently separated in November after 10 years. And to say that, you know, our leadership is really critical at this moment.
So it sounds like for you, really crudely, if I may, that the march is an opportunity to enhance and in some ways create a support network. But also about the march, I mean, this is a mass coalescing of groups, individuals, diversity. How does this play out beyond January 21st? Does this trickle down, trickle up over a longer period of time?
One of the things that I think has been really fascinating, and we're seeing it now, is that public opinion matters. We are more enabled than ever, right, with social media, with connectivity, and we're seeing it especially. I mean, this next administration has not even been, you know, officially inaugurated, and yet we're already seeing that pushback on a lot of things has really taken hold. you know, the Women's March itself is an extremely exceptional example of how grassroots mobilizing is definitely something to behold right now. This march only started being organized, you know, a few short months ago. And as the veterans contingent, we've only been organizing for a couple of weeks, and we have already touched base with over 60 national women's veterans. And half of them have already said, yes, we will actually already be there in place. But we wanted to let you know that we also are veterans. So I definitely think that these are great case studies that really showcase that activism is, and the grassroots activism is very powerful in this moment and will definitely be something that the next administration will have to confront and manage.
You talk about this grassroots effort and mobilizing, and, you know, I'm wondering, from where is the energy? Where are you harnessing the energy? Is some of it coming from, say, a Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who went after the Democratic nomination for president and in trying to get there, walked away with what he called a revolution and far more followers than when he began? I mean, it just seems to me that last year in particular, there was this bundle of energy to tap into.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to the Women's March, women have been at the helm of nearly every fight in history, but we've been made very invisible. The march, you know, has been reported to have over 150,000 RSVP'd confirmed attendees, and it's marked to be the largest demonstration on an inauguration weekend in history. And it's, you know, widely women. We're seeing many of our donors being women. And so I definitely, you know, we definitely think as Vets Versus Hate, we're seeing many veterans that have never been politically active, women, men, veterans and families who have never really been politically active. Military members, for the greater part, are, you know, we're in a community that is, you know, very beholden to be apolitical as public servants, as government, you know, military members. But this has come to a turning point where we are definitely, and I would definitely agree that the Bernie Sanders movement really, really helped propel this feeling that everyone can be politically empowered and everyone has a stake to have a voice. And so this kind of emboldened, you know, I'm going to speak out, especially veterans who, if you think about it, we swore to uphold and defend, you know, the liberties of all Americans. And so we're seeing a lot of military veterans, women, who are saying, well, this is my moment. Even though I'm a civilian, I still know what that feels like, and I'm still here to serve.
How helpful is it for famous women to be associated with this march? I mean, we have Gloria Steinem as an honorary co-chair, for one.
The Women's March organizers themselves, you know, Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, Carmen Perez, they themselves have said that this march is definitely, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And so for these women who have, you know, been trailblazers and blazed the way, I think it's very helpful. Another dynamic to consider is that many of the celebrities and well-known activists who are coming are largely coming as civilians, as themselves, as people. Of course, it's helpful, and I don't think it detracts from the fact that this was a people power initiated movement.
Is there a service, a policy, a right, something you're concerned will disappear under the Trump administration?
That's a great question, and it's very loaded because there's so much to choose from, to be honest. This next administration, our elected leaders are definitely already carrying out, and it feels to me as threats to our livelihood and liberty on a range of different issues. As a woman, as a veteran, the intersection of women's rights and why this women's march is so critical is definitely a big one. There was recent news of the next administration asking the State Department for the names of folks who have worked on gender equality issues and foreign policy. That's startling. To me, that feels like a threat to our progress. I think veterans have a really strong pulse on foreign policy. We're so impacted by how will we be used as a military force. And so a lot of the foreign policy talk impacts our military greatly, and I think is very concerning, right? And furthermore, as women who are already lesser known and not really visible, it does feel look at the makeup of the next cabinet, right? It feels a little bit as we will be even further marginalized or ignored. And that's why this is such a great and exciting moment for the Women's March, for us to say, no, we will not be ignored. We are here, we are contributors, and we are leaders.
Pam, I know you care about gender and leadership, women and leadership. How do you see women in leadership or lack thereof in the Trump administration and in general?
For me, the bottom line is that inequality of voices, an absence of a diversity of voice and thought and experience is toxic and dangerous for everybody. Just as we, women, being absent at the table is bad for us, it's equally as bad for men. And you're seeing that. We're seeing that with the Women's March and especially our veterans contingent. It's led by women, myself, and many underrepresented women, women of color, queer women, and men saying, you know, I want to stand shoulder to shoulder with you. I want to help. I want to be told how I can help. It's really dangerous for there to be a perpetuation of a monolith, of having the same type of thought, the same type of experience at the table. And so that's really something that we talk about a lot. And it's something that I'm very unapologetic about, is that more than ever, women's leadership is not only craved, but it's needed.
So stepping back to a more local level, how do you foster interest in creating a pipeline of women for leadership? How do we make sure that women are in line to rise up the ranks politically?
It is happening, regardless of, you know, a lot of the concerning aspects of this past election, is that there is excitement. There are people that are coming out of the woodwork to be involved, whether it's at a grassroots level as activists. We are seeing very young, post 9/11, gay, Latina, Marine, who is in school, who wants to know how she can run. How do politics work? And so there is that interest. And there are many organizations across the country who are capitalizing on it and helping build that pipeline of women's leadership and political office. And service means many different things. I mean, veterans know that high and well, that serving our communities takes a lot of different forms. And again, kind of to our previous point, this grassroots organizing that we're seeing take fold across the country in all sorts of communities is really exciting. That lends to that. And while the next administration at the federal level is concerning and does not represent women, we have seen many wins from women of color at many different levels. You know, I'm very familiar with Portland, Oregon's politics, where they have an all-female county commissioner board, right? And so we are seeing this, and we will see more of it, which I think will be very interesting, and it will be a bit of a clash with the next administration's policies, and like I said, their attempts to ignore and subdue communities like women and other underrepresented groups.
You know, you seem to engender a lot of what is out there, and that is this energy we spoke about before. But I feel like I'm keying into this combination of extreme concern, but with a strong and positive approach.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a mantra that I know is beholden to the vets versus hate community. A lot of people are suffering. I mean, that goes without saying, but it's important to make explicit. A lot of people are in fear, and a lot of people feel isolated and alone. But this is a great opportunity, and I know that that's what our movement wants to do. That's what the Women's March is seeking to do. This isn't a protest. These movements have been building up for some time. This isn't relatively new. I think that as a lot of the doom and gloom of 2016, there was great opportunity and there were cracks made. You know, vets versus hate, fighting the narrative that the right has a monopoly on patriotism. We're seeing so many veterans of different experiences, Muslims, you know, underrepresented folks, come out and say, well, actually, I have a range of different ideas. You know, myself, I asked Secretary Clinton a question at the Commander-in-Chief Forum as a progressive who had a range of different nonpartisan ideas. And so I think that there is definitely kind of an upheaval of activism and of optimism that this is our opportunity because we have been challenged. And challenge is good. Veterans know that well and clear. And we're a diverse group. And so the time is right and the time is now. And I definitely am very excited for the Women's March and for us to see on a national scale, kicking off this new administration a day after the new government, to hold elected leaders across the aisle accountable, because it's definitely an interesting political time.
That was Pam Campos-Palma, an Air Force veteran who served as a geopolitical operations intelligence analyst. She is a leader of Women Vets March on D.C., which will be part of the larger Women's March on Washington. Campos also is part of Veterans vs. Hate, a veterans initiative pushing back against fear-mongering and bigotry. Most recently, Campos served as an international consultant for the United Nations Population Fund in Eastern and South Africa, as strategy team lead for a global social venture in Guatemala, and with a poverty relief non-governmental organization working in Honduras. Ahead of a new Trump administration, many transgender people have been worried about policy changes affecting their ability to legally change name and gender, and hundreds of attorneys across the country have volunteered to help people file applications. Karen Shikurji reports.
Attorney Ann Williams is meeting her 33-year-old client for the first time at a legal clinic in Rochester. She's asking him questions about what it's like to have one name and gender legally and another name and gender in real life.
So has it ever happened at medical appointments? I know they're really good about here about using preferred names.
They've gotten better.
The client takes out a tin black box out of his bag. He pulls out a passport, birth certificate, social security card, and license. They all say female, but the client, he's a trans man.
They'd use female pronouns instead of male, even when I start coming up with more facial hair.
The client is here to change his legal name and gender. Now, New York State usually requires that name changes get published in a local paper, but for safety reasons, the client is also asking a judge to waive that requirement. Because of that, we're not going to use his name either.
So I want to be safe, perceived as who I am, something that a lot of people don't think about, but it's something that when you're different, you'd think about a lot.
A new report from the National Center for Transgender Equality found that 30% of respondents ran into problems when they showed an ID that didn't match their appearance. Problems like verbal harassment, problems like being asked to leave a place, problems like being physically attacked.
Especially if we're going into an environment where we're getting more conservative in our country and having a backlash against people who are different, it's nice to have everything kind of match up.
Under the Obama administration, the criteria for changing gender on a federal ID was redefined. Before 2010, only people who had gotten surgery could change their gender legally. But the policies changed to include anyone receiving transition-related care, as long as they could provide a letter from a doctor. Many are concerned that option will just go away, and that's why legal help is popping up across the country. This session is one of three organized by Attorney Milo Primo, who works at the Empire Justice Center, a New York State advocacy organization.
The policies we're talking about here are just that, they're policies, they're administrative policies. So the new heads of the Social Security Administration, the Department of State, could easily get rid of those policies.
Primo usually advises about 15 people a month for name and gender marker changes. But since the election, about 50 people have signed up for these legal clinics in Rochester alone.
You think, okay, does somebody really need a gender marker change with Social Security? What difference does that make? It makes a difference with your ability to access certain benefits and spousal benefits and retirement benefits. It can impact your ability to access Medicaid and Medicare that won't discriminate against you based on your gender marker on your records.
Arlie Christian, a policy advisor with the National Center for Transgender Equality, says she hasn't heard anything about potential changes yet.
We work very closely with many folks in the federal agencies that house these policies. We haven't had any indication that they're our thoughts of changing the federal gender marker change policies.
But for now, the uncertainty is enough to make people organize.
And just in case you forgot anything with the application. Mm-hmm.
Attorney Ann Williams has her notary stamp ready in hand. Her client is now sitting next to her, and they're going over a printout of the application.
Legal name, correct?
Legal name.
Yep.
After his application gets approved by a judge, he'll have to go to each agency, state and federal, to update IDs one by one.
Super exciting. It is.
I'm glad.
He's hoping to do that as soon as possible. Karen Shikurji, Side Effects Public Media.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. Now we go to the archives for a story about Martin Luther King Jr. The following is a production of This Land Press. For more information, visit thislandpress.com. Mary McAnally shares the story of how she organized the only Freedom Bus from Oklahoma during the Civil Rights Movement. She went with 40 University of Tulsa students and participated in sit-ins in Montgomery, Alabama.
When you feel like you're linking your life arm in arm with the life of people like Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King, people who have even sacrificed their lives for their cause, it's a holy feeling. My name is Mary McAnally. In 1960, I was a student at TU, and Martin Luther King came there to speak. He urged students to come down south and sit with him in the sit-in demonstrations that they were having. The lunch counter sit-ins were the attempt to get government to require that restaurants allow black people to eat at restaurants where white people eat. That spring, which was 1961, I had just turned 21, I organized the only Freedom Bus that went from Oklahoma down south. It was during spring break. We played cards and told jokes, and boys and girls met up. You know, 40 college kids. It's an exciting, incredible group of young people. We went to a hotel that King had set aside for Freedom Bus people. When King came and said, okay, let's go, we're going over here to this restaurant, you five go there, and you five go there, and you know, boy, we marched in tune. I went to a restaurant that was a trolley car restaurant. You know, they used to take old trolley cars and turn them into a restaurant. It was in a part of town that was where the white part of town was beginning to get colored. I used the term as they did then. And so there were colored people wanting to eat at the restaurant and being refused. So we went in and, you know, we were mixed race and sat down, and you could feel the hostility. And within any time at all, the waitress would come over and said, we can't serve you here, you'll have to leave. We didn't get right up and leave. We said, why can't you serve us? You've run out of food? We're hungry, and we're from, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we came here to get something to eat. They ended up calling the police, and the police came in and arrested us. There were five in my group, but by the time they took us to jail, there were already about 80 people at the jail. It took 6 hours, I know, for them to process me, and took me almost that long to get to the telephone to call my mother to ask her to wire me $25 for the fee, which she did. King told us, he said, you might be arrested, so be prepared for that. But if you are, you'll be in good company.
You just listened to a This Land Press production. Check out thislandpress.com for more details. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1434.